Okay then, brethren, last week we began what's going to be a series looking at how we use our tongues, our words, making sure that our heart and mouth are properly connected, and I had intended to speak further on that topic today, but I'm not, because there have been some prophetic developments, which I think might be worth just updating us all. So next week, we'll get back to looking at the question of our words and our tongues and how we control them. But this today is really an update. So I've entitled the message Daniel and a Turkey Update. Turkey not being the bird you have on your plate, but the country of Turkey. And you may recollect it was about 1 year ago, I think, we last had an update on a prophecy. And there have been some very recent developments, like in the past 2 weeks, regarding Turkey in particular. So I thought it's worth an update, just in case things start moving. Now, of course, whenever we talk of prophecy, we have to recognize there's going to be some speculation. And, of course, our track record in the churches of God has not been very good. In terms of speculation, in fact, has been basically rubbish. So we need to be very cautious about reading too much into world events because we've not been very good at it. But nonetheless, it is good that all of us do remain alert and watchful because things are happening. Now, what I've said in the past is, number one, we should all be very familiar with the text of Scripture, what the Scripture actually literally says, the narrative. So if I say to you what's in Daniel 8 or Daniel 2, really, you ought to know what the words are. And we can all do that. Secondly, we need to be very careful and responsible in how we interpret the text. So we should know the basic text, the narrative. Now, as to what that means, that's when we have to be a little bit more careful and responsible. And then thirdly, we should recognize that thereafter, we're often speculating when we look at world conditions and see how they allegedly fulfill prophecy. That's much more dodgy. And we should recognize speculation is speculation. Hopefully it's sensible and plausible and fits with the Scripture, but speculation is speculation, so let's just recognize that. But certainly Jesus himself implied that you and I should be watchful of world conditions. Let's open our Bibles in Matthew 16 and read verses 1 through 4. So Matthew and chapter 16, it says, verse 1, Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came and, testing Jesus, asked that he would show them a sign from heaven. Jesus answered and said to them, When it is evening, you say, It will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, you say, It will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening. Hypocrites, you know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given to it, except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And Jesus left them and cleared off. Mm-hmm. But notice verse 3, Jesus condemned them. He says, you can tell the weather in the next few hours by looking at the sky, but he says, you cannot discern the signs of the times. You're blind to what's happening around you. You can't see it. And that's really a condemnation that Jesus made of the Pharisees and Sadducees, and really, it's a potential condemnation of you and me. Because can we discern the signs of the times? Do we know whether we're in the end time, and if so, how far through it? Do we know whether events are about to kick off and a major storm envelop the earth or not? we should have some discernment. Look at Matthew 24, verses 15 through 18. This comes right in the middle of the so-called Olivet prophecy. But picking up in verse 15, Jesus says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," in brackets, "whoever reads, let him understand, then," when you see that, "then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes." And it tells us the great tribulation is about to occur, when almost no flesh would be saved alive. And the trigger for that, verse 15, is when you, Jesus' disciples, when you see the abomination of desolation, the one spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So a couple of things there. One is you have to be watching, alert, a watchful to see it, because many people won't see it, or when they see something happening, they won't recognize what it is. So Jesus says, when you see it, because you're watching, and what you see is the abomination of desolation that Daniel the prophet described. We find that in Daniel 9 and Daniel 11, I think, and 12. Right? So what Jesus is saying there is, you and I need to understand at least some prophecy. And we need to be watching world events so that we can see prophecy fulfilled. And then when you see this particular prophecy fulfilled, if you're in the area, get out in a hurry. So that shows us the importance of being watchful, and watchful in conjunction with some reasonable prophetic understanding. Not saying we have to be brilliant, but some of the key points we should recognize. Now, of course, over the years, most of us and many others have watched Europe and the Vatican, looking for 10 nations in Europe to unite, probably led by Germany. That's what the Worldwide Church of God and the Philadelphia Church of God and most other churches of God, the living and so on, have done. The Roman view, as it's called, is very popular with prophecy enthusiasts. Not just the Church of God. You know, other popular writers like Hal Lindsey and others have all said, look to Europe. Look to 10 nations uniting. Look to the Vatican. Well, as I've explained before, I believe that view is wrong. If we're looking at Europe and Rome and the papacy, we're looking in the wrong direction. And that could be a problem. If you're looking in one place and prophecy is being fulfilled in a different place, you could be caught out. So without going into all the detail all over again, let me just go over a couple of key points as to why I believe we should be focusing our attention more on Iran and Turkey, not Europe. Now, I think I spoke about maybe 20 different messages on this topic a couple of years ago. So today's is going to be pretty much abbreviated, just a summary. There's a lot of information I covered in those days, which I'll be missing today. So if you are interested in the topic, you could always, if you find the time, dive in to some of those earlier messages. But let's ask the first question, well, why did we all come up with Rome in the first place? Where did this Roman idea, Europe and 10 nations, where did that come from? How did it start? If it's wrong, where did we first go wrong? Okay, let's turn to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2, and we read verses 36 to 44. Now, Daniel 2 is where Nebuchadnezzar has this dream of a gigantic statue, its head of gold and then silver and bronze and legs of iron. And eventually, Daniel comes forward with the interpretation. So we'll pick up the interpretation in verse 36. "This is the dream," said Daniel, "and now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king Nebuchadnezzar. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over all. You are this head of gold." So that's Nebuchadnezzar and the kingdom of Babylon, the head of gold. "After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth." And I think most folk agree those are the kingdoms of Babylon. And then the silver is Persia. The bronze is Greece. There's pretty much general agreement about that. And if you want to put that in today's modern language, Babylon is modern Iraq. In the news most weeks of the year, Persia is known today as Iran. In the news most weeks of the year, Greece, of course, we know is Greece. But here we come to the fourth kingdom, verse 40. "And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will," now notice, "will break in pieces and crush all the others." We'll come back to that. "Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay, partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron, partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay." Then, of course, the fourth kingdom comes to an end. Verse 44, "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed." Talking of Jesus' return and the kingdom of God. "And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. And it," God's kingdom, "shall stand forever." So here are four kingdoms, the gold, the silver, the bronze. But the question would be, well, what's this iron kingdom? What's this fourth kingdom? And the idea that it was Rome probably started with a guy called Hippolytus, H-I-P-P-O, as in the animal, L-Y-T-U-S, Hippolytus, around about 200 AD. And of course, he was living in the Roman Empire. He was a Roman theologian, and he looked around and said, well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? You know, we've had Babylon, we've had Persia, we had Greece, now, you know, the kingdom, the empire, I live in Rome. That's the fourth one, it's pretty obvious. That's what he said and taught. Later on, Jerome, who translated the Bible into Latin, another famous theologian and philosopher, in 408 AD, he stated in his commentary on the book of Daniel, quotes, "Now the fourth empire clearly refers to the Romans." And that's it. Starting way back in those days, 200-400 AD, people said, "Hey, it's Rome, pretty obvious." And thereafter, right down to today, people generally have gone along with that view. And in fact, if you use the Amplified Bible and look at Daniel 2:40, it actually has brackets after the fourth kingdom, brackets, Rome, brackets. So the Amplified translators actually stick the word Rome in the scriptures, which is a bit naughty, because it can't be Rome. Might have seemed logical, Babylon, then Persia, and then Greece, and Rome comes along later, so the fourth kingdom's obviously Rome. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, it might make sense in one way, but actually fails the test of Scripture. Because look at Daniel 2:40, and this is where Rome collapses in a heap as the fourth kingdom. Notice, the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom, the fourth kingdom, will break in pieces and crush all the others. Right? Now, other translations, the word break in pieces, or the words break in pieces, is a Hebrew word pronounced, I think, dekak. That's D-E-Q-A-Q, dekak. Right? It's translated break in pieces. Other translations use words like shatter. This fourth kingdom shall shatter. Some use smash. Others use pulverize. The fourth kingdom shall pulverize, smash, shatter, break in pieces all the others. Now here's the problem. Rome never did that. Rome fails the Bible test because Rome never pulverized, crushed, shattered all the others. Now, Rome defeated Greece, the third empire militarily, about 146 BC. But Rome certainly didn't crush or pulverize Greece. The Romans actually had a very high regard and admiration for Greek culture, for Greek art, for Greek architecture. Lots of architecture in Rome is copied and modeled on Greece. The Romans had great admiration for Greek literature, Greek philosophy, even the Greek religion. They borrowed lots of their gods and goddesses. And even the Greek language continued to be the language of the Roman Empire. The New Testament, for example, was written in Greek because Greek was the lingua franca of the entire world during the Roman Empire days. So Rome fails, and it talks about pulverizing, smashing and crushing all the others. Rome never conquered Persia. Never. Let alone smash and pulverize it. So, I've been through this in detail in the past, but fundamentally, Rome fails Daniel 2:40. It doesn't do what the fourth kingdom is to do. Look at Daniel 2:44. You see the word dekak again. The very last sentence in Daniel 2:44 says that God's kingdom shall break in pieces all the others. It's the same word, dekak. Because God's kingdom will smash, pulverize, shatter everything that stands in his way. And that's what the word break in pieces means. The kingdom of God's not going to just absorb the USA and the kingdoms of France and China and their government systems. No, when Jesus returns, everything, all governments, all systems, education, defense, pharmaceutical, drugs, everything is smashed to pieces, blown away. That's what the word dekak means, and Rome, the Roman Empire, fails the test. Now, additionally, you could look at a map. If you look at a map of the ancient Roman Empire, Persian Empire, Babylonian Empire, Greek Empire, you'll see that actually Rome's in the wrong place. The Roman Empire is set pretty much to the west of the continent. Babylon, Persia, and Greece are to the east. We overlap in the middle, but basically they're different parts of the world. So, if it wasn't Rome, then what was the fourth empire? Like I've explained in the past at some length, it appears to be the Islamic Empire. The Empire of Islam, which started in Arabia around in the 600s AD, and then spread pretty rapidly over the centuries, taking over more and more of the Middle East, into Arabia, all across North Africa, across Europe, up to and including Spain. And the Islamic Empire absorbed Babylon, modern-day Iraq. It absorbed and defeated Persia, modern-day Iran. It absorbed and defeated Asia Minor, Turkey, and the countries around that. And yes, the Islamic Empire pulverized, smashed in pieces, the culture, the languages, even the alphabet changed to Arabic. Our laws completely changed, with Sharia law introduced. Religion completely changed from whatever it was to Allah and his prophet Muhammad. So the Fourth Empire turns out, for lots of reasons explained, you know, a couple of years back, to be the Islamic Empire. And if you think about it, you know, at one point in time, in the few hundred years after Jesus' day, North Africa was loosely Christian. Now, we might not say true church, but Christian insofar as, you know, they had churches and they worshipped Jesus Christ and the God of the Bible and had Bibles and so on. North Africa, the Middle East, was all Christian. What happened to the Christian Middle East? What happened to Christian North Africa? What happened to the Christian churches of Asia Minor, the ones that Paul wrote to, Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamum, the churches of Revelation? What happened to them all? Islam steamrolled them all. You could ask today, you know, how many Jews did Hitler kill? Everybody come up with 6 million, I think. Well, everybody knows that answer. But ask how many people Islamic Jihad has killed. People, I don't know. What number would that be? And one estimate puts the number killed in 1,400 years of Islam rule at about 270 million. Now, that must be an estimate, I imagine, but it's a pretty big number, particularly the world was a lot smaller in those days than it is today. And today, Islam occupies 25% of the world's landmass is under Islamic rule. 25% of the population of the world is Islamic. 25% of the sovereign countries on the earth are Islamic. You know, the Islamic empires ran for about 1,400 years up to just after World War I. And for the last 600 of those years, it was the Ottoman Empire, which you now know as really modern-day Turkey, that was in charge. So there's a ton of information we covered before, so I'm not going to repeat all of that. But the Ottoman Empire, which ran for the last 600 years of the Islamic Empire, one of the world's longest empires, ended in 1922. That's just about 100 years ago. The office of what they call the caliph, who is the supreme leader of Islam, politically, religiously, spiritually, everything, he's the top dog. That office of the caliph was closed in Turkey in 1923-24. There's reason to believe that the closing of the Islamic Empire in 1922-23 was the deadly wound to the beast of Revelation 13. We might touch on that a wee bit at the end of today's discussion. So that's a bit of a potted history of why I'm suggesting, well, you can continue to look at Rome if you want, and Europe and Germany, no problems doing that. I think it doesn't work scripturally, but if you want to do that, fine. What I would suggest, though, is in addition to doing that, you do pay a lot of attention to Turkey and Iran and the Middle East. I believe that scripturally where we're going to see most of the activity. So where are we then today in prophecy and what's happening recently? Well, let's turn to Daniel 8, read verses 3 through 8. Daniel chapter 8 is the key chapter in terms of what's going to happen next, I believe. Daniel 8. Because Daniel 8 identifies two key countries and two major wars between those countries, right? And that appears to be something scheduled for our time. Picking up in verse 3 of Daniel 8, "Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. And I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, southward, so that no beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great." So the first major player we've got is this ram with two horns. And this ram goes on the rampage to the north, to the south, to the west. And nobody can stand against it, at least in this geographical area. And it succeeds for a while, but there's a counterattack sometime later, verse 5. "And as I was considering," says Daniel, "suddenly a male goat," or a he-goat, "came from the west," clearly heading east, "across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, so great speed. And the goat," this he-goat, "had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I'd seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power." This is a battle of two powerful nations. "And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him to the ground and trampled the ram. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat," the he-goat, "grew very great. Although when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven." So, I've said in the past, we should know the narrative, the text. We should know Daniel 8 talks about a ram charging around and a he-goat charging against him at some point, and the he-goat ends up victorious. That's what the text tells us. We should know the text. The question of what the text means, we try to do that sensibly and responsibly, and then we look around at the world and we may then speculate a little bit, but we try and keep it all sensible. Two main players here, the ram and the he-goat. When does this take place? Is it something that took place 2,000 years ago? Back in Daniel's day? Is it just historic and really rather irrelevant? Well, look at Daniel 8. Look at verse 17, 19, and 26. Verse 17. "So the angel came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But the angel said to me, 'Understand, son of man," that's Daniel, "that the vision," about the ram and the he-goat, "refers to the time of the end." Okay? So it wasn't for Daniel's day. The vision is about the time of the end. Notice verse 19. "And he said, 'Look, I'm making known to you, Daniel, what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be,'" or the New American Standard Bible says, "'it shall be at the appointed time of the end.'" So again, the end time. Then look at verse 26. "And the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true. Therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future." So the Daniel 8 prophecy is about the end time. I remember Jesus in his day warned his disciples to be familiar with the prophecies of Daniel and the abomination of desolation, which is also the end time. And obviously that was still future from when Jesus was talking. And it's still future, in fact, I believe, today. So this is going to happen sometime ahead of us. Don't know the exact date, unfortunately. Be good to know that, but we don't. So who are the Ram and the He-God? Who are these countries? Who are these big players who are going to go to battle and to war in the end time? Well, Daniel 8, verse 20 tells us, "The Ram which you saw, having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia." Persia is Iran. Simple as that. The Ram is Iran. It's even easy to remember. Iran, Ram, Iram, Iran. Piece of cake. So what's going to happen sometime soonish is Iran is going to go to war across the Middle East to the north, which will take them into southern Russia, to the west. That's going to be into countries like Syria, to the south, Saudi Arabia. These are key territories. And Iran is going to go at them. When they go to the west, that will include the eastern part of Turkey. So Iran, the Ram, is going to launch a blitzkrieg war in the Middle East sometime. Sometime in the end time. Who's the He-Goat? Verse 21. "The male goat is the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn is its first king." Well, kingdom of Greece, not quite accurate. The word Greece is translated from the Hebrew, you know, and the Hebrew word is Javan, J-A-V-A-N, or sometimes Y-A-V-A-N, Javan. And if you look at Bible maps, Bible atlases, I think we put some up on the website and Maureen's notes a couple of years back. There's some maps there under one of the headings. Javan is modern-day Turkey. Istanbul, Ankara, Western Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. It includes also probably parts of Bulgaria, Albania, maybe a little bit of Greece. But for our purposes, the central, most powerful, dominant part of Javan is modern-day Turkey, Western Turkey, Asia Minor. These are the two players. That's what we're going to watch out for in the end time. So, let me just update some background information about these nations. Iran goes on the warpath across the Middle East. Later, Turkey counterattacks and ends up being the dominant nation. You know, this is a battle for supremacy in the Middle East, involving religion, because Iran is Shia Islam, Turkey is Sunni Islam, and they do not get on well together. There's a pushing and shoving as to which is going to be the superior, and obviously there's nationalism involved as well between Iran and Turkey. When this battle happens, even the first part, when Iran rushes out to the north, south, and west, it will have a massive impact on the Persian Gulf area. And what do you get from the Persian Gulf? Oil. Lots of it. In fact, much of the world depends on oil coming from the Middle East and the Persian Gulf, and that's going to possibly stop because of all the warfare, or at least get slowed down dramatically. And that will kill off the economies of many nations, including the USA and Canada and the UK. All will be badly hit if oil supplies are disrupted massively, and they will be. Even faraway countries like Australia, Japan, Korea, all these countries are totally dependent on imported oil from the Persian Gulf. So there will be worldwide chaos, economic chaos, inevitable. You know, there's no oil, no fuel, you know, vehicles won't be running on the roads, trucks, haulage won't take place, banks might foreclose, factories shut down. So the whole world is going to suffer if there's a major war in the Middle East. And that's what Scripture tells us, Daniel chapter 8. So what do we see if we look at these two nations today? Is there any evidence that Iran or Turkey are a problem? Or is it all nice and quiet, peaceful, they're all watching the movies and eating popcorn and slugging back Coca-Cola? Well, Turkey is where I think very significant developments have taken place, particularly in the last 2 weeks, which is why I was prompted to give this update. Now, Turkey is an Islamic country. My wife and family and one of our American visitors went across to Istanbul a couple of years back. Wonderful time there. Fascinating city. Had a tour with a one-day tour with a local guide, young woman, and a fascinating country. Really, really wanted to go back again, but it's changing as we look at it. It has been ruled, it's an Islamic country, and it ruled as the Islamic Ottoman Empire for about 600 years. Mentioned that already. Ending about 1922/23. Since that time, about 100 years ago, it was restructured and set up as a secular nation, no longer an Islamic nation, but the guy in charge of it 100 years back converted it to a secular, non-religious nation. Now, individuals in Turkey are still largely Muslim, and he was happy with that. You know, personally, if you want to worship Allah and read the Quran, you know, worship the Prophet and all the rest of it, fine. But don't bring your Islamic religion into government. Right? He kept the government of Turkey strictly secular. And he even established in the constitution a rule that the military, you know, the army, were not just allowed to intervene, but were commanded to intervene any time that the religious guys got too big for their boots. And a number of times the military have done that. They organize a coup, they sweep in, they reset everything back to secular. That's what the constitution required. But in the past few years, there have been very, very significant changes. The military, for example, after nearly a century, have been outmaneuvered. A large number are now rotting in jail. And Turkey is moving very rapidly back towards being a religious Islamic nation with an Islamic government. That's a complete reversal of the past 100 years. Its current leader, and the man I think we need to watch out for, that's a speculation, but you'll see, I think it sort of ties in, at least seems to at the moment. Its leader is a guy called Recep Erdogan, E-R-D-O-G-A-N, Erdogan, but pronounced Erdogan. He is a devout Muslim, which is fine. Individually, you can be what you want in Turkey. But Mr. Erdogan is a bit special. He has ambitions to restore the Ottoman Empire, with Turkey clearly as its leading nation. And he wants to regain the Ottoman Empire's lost territory and influence. Now, you might remember an attempted military coup back in July 2016, not quite 2 years ago. This was allegedly to reset Turkey back to being secular. Well, the coup lasted only a few hours and hopelessly failed. A lot of suspicion about that. But what it did do was it gave Mr. Erdogan, as Prime Minister, justification, in his eyes at least, to clear out everybody who opposed him, because they were clearly enemies of the state. So over, at that time, over 113,000 were arrested, tens of thousands of police, judges, soldiers, teachers and academics, journalists, come back to journalists in a bit, were dismissed or silenced or in many, many cases, jailed. So anybody who was a professional who opposed them, people like judges who could interpret the law and defend people, dismissed or often jailed, right? He introduced a state of emergency so he could renew, or so he could rule himself. Well, guess what? That was July 2016. It's still in place. He's renewed the state of emergency 6 times already. He's a man who's keen to get all the power to himself. He has, you'd have to say, he has a desire to become the despotic dictator of Javan. Mr. Erdogan has said, listen to this, quote, "Democracy is like a streetcar, you know, a bus coach. You ride it till you get to your stop, and then you get off." Democracy, he's not interested in, it's just a useful vehicle to get you to where you want to go. Then you kick it into touch. Mm-hmm. It's a means to an end. And I know what his end is. This is my guesswork. The guy is a manic who wants to become a dictator. The guide who took us around Istanbul, it's a young woman, she was keen to leave Turkey. She was desperately trying to get her and her family some visas to get out of Turkey and go into Europe. She was studying, Spanish. With the hope she could move out of Turkey to Spain. And I said, "What do you make of Mr. Erdogan?" And she said, "I think he's insane." Well, maybe he is, but there's a cleverness to his insanity. So we just read what he said about democracy. There's no time for it. It's just a useful vehicle. He also wrote a poem. He's a devout Muslim. He wrote a poem, and here's the English translation of his poem. Just listen to some of the words here. He's talking about Islam, the mosques, the believers, and so on. He says, "The mosques are our barracks. The domes are helmets. The minarets are bayonets. And the believers are our soldiers. This holy army guards my religion. Almighty," he says, talking to God or Allah, "Almighty, our journey is our destiny. The end is martyrdom." Guy's got a death wish. Now, it seems that all the major changes in Turkey are down to just essentially this one man, Mr. Erdogan. He has got vision, he's got ambition, he's got personal charisma. Google him, you'll find out quite a lot. You know, on a personal level, ignoring his government for a moment, just looking at the man, Mr. Erdogan, he had a palace built 4 years ago, costing £500 million. Nice little shack. It has 1,100 rooms. Its floor space is 1.6 square miles, which is 30 times bigger than the White House in Washington. It's the biggest residential palace in the world. The carpets alone cost over £7 million. He has silk wallpaper throughout, costing over £2,000 a roll. There are 250 rooms just for the president and his family. I think largely his wife. I think he's got a son as well. I mean, this guy lives in super opulence. What does that reveal about the man? Is he a martyr living in a cave eating, you know, bread crusts and cold water? Or the man living in a 1,000-plus-room, £500 million palace covered in gold and marble and so on? Plus, if he gets bored there, he's got at least 2 other palaces in Turkey. So, you know, you get a picture of the man. Democracy, useful vehicle. Islamic religion, that's our bayonets. And the end of our lives is martyrdom. Lives in super-duper-duper opulence. Now, in our last update, which I think was about early May last year, about 12 months ago, we were discussing at that stage an important referendum that had just taken place in Turkey. The referendum had taken place in 2017 at Easter time. And the people were being asked to vote to agree to very important changes to the Turkish constitution, which would give the president of Turkey, guess who, Mr. Erdogan, a far greater personal power. So this went to a referendum to the people to vote. Now, I won't repeat the actual changes in the constitution. You can find that in last year's update if you're particularly interested. But suffice to say, Mr. Erdogan won the referendum. Only just, 51% to, 49%. There was a lot of suspicion that it was some dishonesty in the voting processes. But, there we go. He did win because he's not unopposed. That's why so many journalists and academics and teachers and soldiers are now dismissed or in jail, because they oppose the guy. They can see where he's going. But, he's in power and he's outsmarting them. Now, the referendum of Easter last year said that the president, whoever that might be at the time, but your guess is probably the same as mine, Mr. Erdogan, can take up his new superpowers at the next general election, November 2019. That's the agreement. So the people narrowly voted to give the president great new powers, which he could take when the next general election occurs, which is November 2019. Now, one commentator at the time said, quotes, "No single man since the days of the Sultans leading the Ottoman Empire will have had such a concentration of power." I mean, he will be unique. The president of Turkey, November 2019, will be unique. So much power at his control. Now, remember Daniel 8 said that the he-goat had a notable horn? Well, as far as I'm concerned, my speculation is that Mr. Erdogan looks to me like he fits the bill, or fits the horn, right? Now, coming up to more recent months, the Daily Express, which is a British newspaper, not probably the finest quality newspaper, but it's sort of middle of the road. They had an article in March, which said that just the month before, a key Turkish newspaper that's very close to Mr. Erdogan and his ruling party had called for an Islamic army to attack Israel. So the assumption is the newspaper speaking sort of on Mr. Erdogan's behalf, and it actually called out to Islamic states to gang together to attack Israel. This is like month before. It called for 57 Islamic states to form a joint army and attack Israel from all sides simultaneously. Now, the newspaper, speaking on behalf of Mr. Erdogan, it is believed, claim they would have 5.2 million active soldiers and a defense budget of $175 billion. The paper said that the first attack against Israel would involve 250,000 soldiers, plus it specified tanks and planes and so on. The Daily Express then states in its comment, Erdogan, quotes, "Erdogan has on several occasions said he would like to resurrect the Ottoman Empire." Now, I'll try and remember to highlight this a bit later on, but notice the Daily Express says Erdogan wants to resurrect the Ottoman Empire. You resurrect something which is dead, right? You resurrect something which is at a deadly wound, a mortal wound, and is dead. That's what you would resurrect, something that's been dead, okay? So the Daily Express says Erdogan has on several occasions said he would like to resurrect the Ottoman Empire, continues. The tyrant, that's what the Express calls him, the tyrant has established military bases in Qatar, Somalia, and Sudan. The article continues. He has threatened to invade the Greek islands in the Mediterranean. He believes they belong to him. And has recently invaded Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism, which is a very useful con you can do these days. You can call anything terrorist and go and attack it. And that's what he's doing. He's sending his troops and army into Syria, fighting off terrorists. No, he's not. He's setting up bases in Syria. Now, that Daily Express article actually was headed World War III. That's probably slightly sensationalist. The Daily Express is a bit like that, but that's what they call that article, World War III. And really, quite honestly, there's too much happening within Turkey to keep up with it. It's just something every week. Now, there's a strong suspicion that Mr. Erdogan has his ambitions on something very special for 2023. That's like 5 years away, because 2023 is the 100-year anniversary of the fall of the old Ottoman Empire. And it seems very likely that he wants to restore the greatness of Islam, with no doubt himself as the number one, potentially, and 2023 looks like it's a date he's aiming for. Now, around Istanbul, when they have political campaigns, lots of the posters that get stuck up in the walls talk about the Ottoman Empire and resurrection again. Curious. Resurrection again. So hopefully, you know, over the past couple of years, we've covered these points off and on. Hopefully we're keeping a bit of an eye on Mr. Erdogan, because he's not going away. What is he up to? Well, this month, now into April, this is what prompted the update, he's probably shown his hand again. I'm going back the week before last, I think it was. You remember that he won the referendum last year, Easter time, which gives the president of the nation in 2019 great new powers? Well, guess what? He's brought forward the election from November 2019 to the 24th of June this year. So he's advanced it 18 months. And that election takes place 8 weeks from now. And I'm pretty sure he's going to win it, honestly, or otherwise. So it looks like he's accelerating his plans. Now, people say that's because he knows there's bad economic times coming to Turkey and he wants to get voted in while things are looking good. Well, maybe that's the case. But the net effect, irrespective, is if he wins, which I'm pretty sure he will, he becomes legally and officially the supreme leader of Turkey, effectively its dictator, and that happens this year. 2 months' time. Now, I don't suppose anyone can say how quickly he'll move after June. He might take weeks or months or years to build up his ideas and ambitions, but he's got the power as of late June this year. And like I said, 2023 is a very important anniversary, so it wouldn't be a huge surprise if he was planning something special for 5 years' time. And who can stop him? Most of the folk who can stop him are in jail. And something's happening almost every week. Even yesterday when I was preparing this message, I came across an editorial in the London Times, which is a better quality newspaper here in the UK. But I'll just read a couple of excerpts from this editorial from yesterday's Times newspaper. It's talking about journalists being jailed again. You don't want to upset Mr. Erdogan, otherwise you end up in a dungeon somewhere. It's headed Despotism in Ankara. Ankara is the capital of Turkey. Istanbul's the main city, but Ankara's its governmental capital. Subheading, the intimidation of the Turkish press heralds a new dark age of absolutism. Quote, the sentencing of 14 journalists from one of Turkey's oldest and most respected newspapers to jail terms of up to 7.5 years on terrorism charges, handy, is a disgrace. It makes a mockery of even the pretense of the democratic freedoms expected of a NATO ally. Turkey, of course, is part of NATO. North Atlantic Treaty Organization. quotes, "It sends a repressive message that opposition to the government will not be tolerated and that Turkey is entering a dark age of absolutism and intolerance." And it is. It continues a bit later. "More than 50,000 have already been arrested, a further 150,000 sacked or suspended from their jobs, including teachers, judges, military officers and public servants. Journalists have been a particular target of President Erdogan." Continuing a bit later, "Mr. Erdogan wants to bring forward presidential elections to June and is intent on cowing, or terrifying, the opposition." And final sentence, it says, "Any notion that Turkey is still a suitable candidate for European Union membership has been locked away, along with the newspapers, journalists." That's from yesterday's paper. So, I mean, every day, every week, there's something happening in Turkey. It's on the march, it's on the move. Now, we've talked quite a lot in the last couple of years about Daniel chapter 8, Turkey, Iran. As far as I'm concerned, still on target, possibly even now picking up speed, because this guy has advanced everything by 18 months. So we need to watch. You know, Turkey, in case you don't know, is in the top 10 military nations on planet Earth. It's a powerful country. It's number two in military power in NATO. Its land army, it's not so big in the air in terms of, you know, jet fighters and so on, but its land army is one of the biggest. Well, it moves. And he's ambitious. He wants his Ottoman Empire back. Let's turn to Revelation 13. Read verses 1 to 3 before we conclude on Turkey. Revelation chapter 13, which I believe is still ahead of us. Verses 1 through 3. And we have discussed this at length in the past in the big long series I did on Islam and prophecy and so on. So again, more details there. This is just a fairly brief summary, but chapter 13, verses 1 through 3. "Then I, John, stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, a deadly wound, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast, who then goes off to make war against the saints." All right? Now, traditionally, our view has been that this beast is sort of, you know, the Roman Empire, and the deadly wound goes back to 476 AD when the Roman Empire came to an end under the onslaught of the Vandals and the Huns and so on. And then it continued for 1260 years, blah, 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 blah. Not so. Because it wasn't the Roman Empire that's in view. In any event, in 476 AD, all that happened was Rome was overrun by the Vandals. The Roman Empire stretched all the way across to Asia Minor, where its capital was Constantinople, named after Emperor Constantine of Rome. And the Roman Empire continued to be ruled from Constantinople. The Roman Empire continued till 1453. Ruled from Constantinople. And then it got destroyed by, you guessed it, the Islamic Empire, who captured Istanbul in 1453, brought an end to the Roman Empire. Anyway, we covered all that in bygone times. So what I'm suggesting here is, verse 3 talks about the mortal wound, which is to be healed. Well, for reasons I've explained in the past, the mortal wound was quite likely, this is speculation, of course, quite likely to have been the destruction of the Islamic empires of the preceding 1400 years, and particularly the Ottoman Empire in 1922-23. That's the deadly wound. Verse 3 says the deadly wound will be healed. 2023, perhaps? Is that when the Ottoman Empire gets restored to power? Well, obviously, we'll have to wait and see. So developments in Turkey seem, you know, quite clear. And that's the he-goat of Daniel chapter 8. That's what I wanted to concentrate on today, really, because with Mr. Erdogan bringing forward the general election, how can you do that, by the way, from November 2019 to this June? Mr. Erdogan will get his dictatorial powers much, much quicker if he wins. But he will. So I don't have time today to say much more about Iran or Persia. They are, of course, the ram of Daniel chapter 8. It goes in the attack first. Today I've concentrated on Turkey because of the recent developments there. But there's plenty happening in Iran. I mean, again, it's hard to keep up with these two countries. Iran is making rapid strides. I'll just make a couple of comments before closing today's review. But there's plenty occurring literally week by week in Iran. Last Sunday, that's quite recent, last Sunday the Guardian newspaper in the UK was talking about Israel's 70th sort of birthday celebrations. And it said, quotes, "The storm now gathering around Israel's borders potentially surpasses in severity anything that country has faced so far." Talking about the problems from every side facing, you know, the nation, the Jewish nation of Israel. It continues in The Guardian. "At its heart, connecting all the geopolitical scrabble pieces is one four-letter word, Iran." The Guardian continues. "In Syria, beyond the Golan Heights, in Lebanon to the north, in Gaza to the south, in Iraq, and possibly even in Jordan to the east, Israel's leaders are watching with growing alarm as Iran's physical and ideological presence and influence steadily spread." And that's happening. It's not happening at breakneck speed at the moment. You know, the blitzkrieg war of Daniel 8 hasn't happened yet, but Iran is day by day, week by week, getting out into the countries, and it's setting up, you know, weapons depots. It's giving money to local militia. Its influence is spreading across much of the Middle East. It's got the money, thanks to Mr. Obama and his so-called nuclear deal of a couple of years back. So it's spreading little by little today, probably tomorrow. But prophecy tells us one day soon it will spread violently. So that was The Guardian's comments about Iran is the problem. It's a problem, its physical presence and also its ideology. Iran is educating and teaching people about why they need Iran. Then if we go back to last December, I know that's probably 4 months ago, 3.5 months ago, the Christian Science Monitor said, quotes, "Iran has emerged from the battlefields in Iraq, Syria and beyond as an unrivaled regional superpower with more hard and soft power capacity to shape events in the Middle East than it has ever before experienced." So Iran is the regional superpower. The Christian Science Monitor continues, quotes, "Iran has emerged as the dominant power in the region." And even its Arab neighbours are deeply concerned. You know, Saudi Arabia has a new young leader, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and he was interviewed on 60 Minutes, the American news programme, last month. And he referred to Iran's top leader, the Ayatollah, as the new Hitler of the Middle East. Now, of course, they're quite often rude to each other. wouldn't read too much necessarily into calling the Ayatollah Khamenei the new Adolf Hitler of the Middle East. But the reason that Crown Prince Mohammed gave to 60 Minutes was because he wants to expand. Now, that's interesting. The Saudi Arabian Crown Prince knows Iran wants to expand. What do we see in Daniel 8? The Ram, Iran, pushes to the north, the south, and the west. Expanding, but Daniel 8's expansion is a violent expansion. So, I mean, you have a look around the internet. There's plenty of information about Iran and its ambitions and its growing influence. And I would simply say that if you look at what's happening in Turkey and its developments, you look at Iran, what's happening in Iran and the countries it's currently influencing, like Iraq. They say that Iraq's actually run by Iran now. That's what they're saying. The Iranians got into Iraq and they've taken over the key administration. So Iraq, Babylon, is today effectively being run by Iran. Iran has huge amounts of military in Syria. Right? They're all over the shop, like a bad rash. You just look around, and what can you say? I'd summarize and say, all the ducks are lining up. All we need now is something to spark the Middle East, some trigger event that will let loose Iran on its rampage, followed up, of course, by the Turkish counterattack. And that will cause chaos in the entire world, not because there'll be tanks rolling up and down the streets of London, Birmingham, or San Antonio, San Francisco, San Diego, but of course all of our countries will be massively impacted by economic chaos when the oil from the Middle East stops for months or years. So when that happens, you know, hold on tight. Because we're all in for a white knuckle ride starting, who knows? But it could be sooner than we think. Well, okay then, brethren, that's today's update. I know there's quite a bit of background material to cover there, but quite honestly, just in your own time, just pop in the word Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Erdogan on Google. There's plenty to occupy you for reading. Now, the journalists, the commentators can see the problems, they can see the threats from Iran. Mr. Donald Trump sees the threats from Iran and he's thinking next month of possibly rescinding the Obama nuclear deal. Well, that might prompt some activity. Look at Turkey, watch the elections, see what Mr. Erdogan does afterwards. The commentators in the world see all the events, they can see the dangers, they can see the risks. What, of course, they don't have is Daniel chapter 8. So you and I can look at Daniel 8 and think, we know where this is going. We haven't got any timing yet, but we know where this is going. And like I said, it'll be a white-knuckle ride. So get ready to hang on tight. Okay, with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.